This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You've reached the edge of the world. You know, folks, every once in a while, we get an incredibly unusual guest here. I find all of my guests fascinating, and they wouldn't be on the show. But there's one guest in particular who knows more about certain absolutely enthralling things than I think probably anybody else in the world. He's been on Dreamland two times. There's wonderful stuff in the subscriber area from him. He's been on William Henry's Revelations talking about masonry. He's Robert W. Sullivan. His specialty is cinema symbolism. Robert, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Whitley, for having me back on Dreamland. It's a pleasure to be here, and I look forward to it. And it's always wonderful to be on your tremendous podcast.
Well, thank you. Yeah, it's a pretty big podcast. That's true. It's got 70,000 listeners. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's been around a long time. It was one of the first podcasts, and, you know, people have been coming back, and new people come to the podcast all the time. And it's not a really sensational sort of podcast. It's more thoughtful, and it's not a place where you're going to be horrified or grossed out or anything. But anyway, that's not necessarily true of the movies. And here's the first question I have for you. Symbolism is so deeply integrated into movies. I wonder how much of it is intentional and how much of it just comes out of a kind of the zeitgeist.
Yeah, I think a lot of it is intentional. I think there's too much overwhelming evidence for it not to be, and especially when you're getting into some real minutia of films. It is an incredible study as to the length some directors will go to place things into movies, to reference other things, to draw things to your subconscious mind, to play a symbolic game of chess with you. So I do believe a lot of it is intentional, but I also allow for the fact that, you know, we are dealing with topics such as, like you said, you know, where it could be unintentional. We deal with ideas of the collective unconscious, consciousness, Carl Gustav Jung. The idea of archetypal imagery being implanted in our subconscious minds. And we also deal with the concept of these filmmakers are aware of this. So they toy with your subconscious mind, and they know it. You find a lot of archetypal imagery repeating itself in films. So I believe my research has led to me to believe that most of it is intentional, but there's an exception to every rule.
Well, that's fascinating because movies are so filled with symbolism. And, you know, I've been on the sets of movies where a lot of symbolism appeared. And I've often wondered what was in the director's minds because no one ever said to me, well, we're going to do this because of the symbolic significance of this.
Right.
But it's there nevertheless. Now, let's start out with the whole world of Hollywood. Now, you know, it's a magical world and full of magical people on the one hand. On the other hand, it's a very difficult and dog-eat-dog world. And obviously, lately for women, it turns out it's a really dangerous world, too.
Sure.
Because they, of course, that business of sleeping your way to the top goes back all the way to the beginning of Hollywood. It's not new. But nevertheless, this is a place where we have done something as a species that's quite new. We have turned ourselves into visions of light. And that, I think, is just so profound and so deep. Can you comment maybe a little bit on the significance of Gnosticism in relation to Hollywood? Because Gnosticism, folks, as you know, is an old set of Christian beliefs that are basically centered around the idea that there is such a thing as living light.
Absolutely. Gnosticism is a very popular theme in Hollywood. You know, I talk about in the book, you can also, you know, this ties into the whole idea of the movie, it's a very strange paradox, because Gnosticism entails the, you know, rejection of materialism and the rejection of, you know, commercialism, yet a Gnostic movie, say like The Truman Show or The Matrix or something like Fight Club, you know, a film is designed to make money. So you do have this sort of paradox with this. And you have the idea of, you know, just films in general, of where the movie can be Gnostic in its themes with the characters, you know, on the screen. We'll talk about The Matrix. That's a good example of this. But, you know, the movie is also supposed to be enlightening the audience, you know, serving as a modality almost to enlighten the person watching it. You know, I mean, you're in a theater, sitting in a pew-like setting in a church, you know, receiving light from the screen, so you're receiving wisdom. But yes, Gnosticism is a very ancient theology. It's a Christian heresy. It entails concepts related to divine spark ignition, what you call consciousness expansion. And you find this in major movies. We find this in The Matrix, you know, with the whole idea. One of the main Gnostic doctrines is the idea of a false reality, a reality that's materialistic, that's controlled by a sort of false god known as the Demiurge. And he runs the universe, this false world, quite imperfectly with a group of agents known as the Archons. So we find this in The Matrix, of course, with Neo and the false reality and him being brought to light. You know, when he finally wakes up, he's lifted cruciform up onto the Nebuchadnezzar to receive the light, to receive the knowledge that he's now in the real world. And of course, we have the architect, the creator of the false reality, and we have the agents who are the Archons. And then we get into something like The Truman Show with Jim Carrey, where, you know, it's again the false reality, the phony reality, the materialistic world. You know, where it's all it's doing is hawking wares. And of course he wants, you know, enlightenment. He wants gnosis. I mean, even his name, you know, he's the true man. He wants to know his place in the world. And, you know, much akin to Neo Anderson at the end of The Matrix. I mean, you look at Truman Burbank, Jim Carrey, I mean, both of them ascend into the sky at the end of the movie, you know, very Christ-like, you know, the Christ-like savior figure. So yes, Gnosticism is, very important within Hollywood. I mean, I'm just scratching the surface with this. I mean, I haven't seen the movie yet, but I'm told that the recent Darren Aronofsky movie called Mother, I have not seen it yet, but I'm told that that has some very Gnostic overtones in it.
Oh, yeah, I have seen it, and it's incredibly profound. One of the most difficult movies to watch I've ever seen, and one of the most beautiful, and it reaches you in your depths because it is about our mother. Our mother and the way we treat her, that we are a kind of relentless magician who will not release her from the burden and bondage of bearing us. Now, it's a fantastic movie, but folks, ain't easy. Ain't easy. Okay. Listen, you know, what we're going to do right now is something that we do at this time or approximately this time every week. And our free Dreamlanders love it because this takes them into another deeper world, the world of things they need to do. Free Dreamlanders, we'll be right back. And now for my new thing. This is Whitley Strieber. And Anne and I have got a new book out called The Afterlife Revolution. You can get it for your Kindle. It's soon going to be available as an audiobook and as a paperback on Amazon. You can find it all there. This is a book that happened because within hours of passing on, Anne came back, and she did it very cleverly. So that I couldn't say to myself, it's just my imagination. What she says is so illuminating and so surprising. Like, I asked her, what are you now? And she said, we're light, alive. I asked her what enlightenment was. And she said, enlightenment is what happens when there is nothing left of us but love. The book's full of material like that and lots more. What a journey it's been for Anne and Whitley, from a deathbed to this beautiful new relationship. The marriage goes right on down the road. We have not finished with each other yet. Join us in the Afterlife Revolution. We're talking to Robert Sullivan. His new book, Cinema Symbolism 2, goes way deeper, and you don't have to read the first one in order to enjoy the second one, believe me. This is really rich material. His website is www.robertwsullivaniv.com. That's as in Robert W. Sullivan the Fourth.com. And you can get the book there from Amazon, pretty much anywhere that you want to look for it. Now, Robert, I want to go a little deeper into the Gnostic realm. And the reason is that your listeners on this show, many of them know a lot about Gnosticism. But there's an absolutely phenomenal, fascinating reference in the book to Tyler Durden in Fight Club. He was the character, folks, played by Brad Pitt. He is an alchemical trickster and explosive expert wizard. And he says, you have to consider the possibility that God does not like you. He never wanted you. In all probability, he hates you. This is not the worst thing that can happen because we don't need him. Robert, that level of nihilism is implicit in some different types of Gnosticism. And tell us a little bit more about this, if you will expand on this a little bit.
Absolutely. Yeah, the movie Fight Club with Brad Pitt and Ed Norton is very Gnostic. I would list it in probably one of my in the top five Gnostic movies of all time. Certainly with The Matrix probably being number one. But yes, you have this, you know, what I would call Valentinian. Valentinus was a very important Gnostic, theologian. He's one of the main fountainheads of Gnostic thought. And it is. It's this idea of rebellion against materialism, rebellion against commercialism. You have the alchemical trickster almost. You know, this is the Mercury character in the form of Tyler Durden, who is, of course, one and the same with the narrator, which is Ed Norton. And it's rare to find that, you know, the trickster character, the trickster archetype, that's the better word to describe it. It's usually someone else or something that allows the character to transition. And this is what the Fight Club movie is about. I mean, of course, he starts out as this sort of lowly character, and he winds up being, through this alchemical transition, this, you know, revolutionary figure, the Ed Norton character. But the Tyler Durden figure is really interesting because what he's talking about in that line you read is exactly what we're talking about with Gnosticism, which is a rebellion against the demiurge, rebellion against his materialism, rebellion against his commercialism for spiritual gnosis. And this is exactly what Tyler Durden is teaching. Or his teachings are, it's really the physical and deconstruction of the self, both physically and spiritually, to be reborn, to have divine spark ignition, to have consciousness expansion. This is the underlying occult undercurrent of the movie Fight Club. Very interesting name. You also have with Fight Club, this is something I talked about in the first book, but I touched on it in the second book as well. You know, when you're dealing with Gnosticism, inevitably you're dealing with secret societies, Freemasonry, and it's a very fascinating name they gave to this guy, Tyler Durden. If you recall in the movie, Tyler is the guardian of the mystery school. You know, this is where the space monkeys come to, you know, learn, you know, the mysteries of Fight Club. You know, you don't talk about Fight Club. You know, rule number one, rule number two, you don't talk about Fight Club. It's the spiritual deconstruction of the self. You know, you constantly hear him barking at the space monkeys, you know, you are not special. You're not the ID in your wallet. But of course, if you remember when they start showing up at the house to get in, Tyler says you have to stand there for 3 days. You have to be unencouraged, you know, and then you can gain entry. Well, I mean, you think 3 days, you're thinking of the first three levels of Blue Lodge Freemasonry. And what's really interesting is in Blue Lodge Freemasonry, the guy who guards the entrance to the Masonic temple, who guards the entrance to the Masonic mysteries, is actually named Tyler. The Tyler guards the entrance to the Masonic Lodge. So it's only symbolically appropriate that Tyler Durden, guards the mysteries of Fight Club. It's a very fascinating movie. I absolutely love it, and I completely agree that it's a very Gnostic film, rebellion against the demiurge, rebellion against materialism, and you'll find it all right there on the big screen, just a little concealed beneath the celluloid.
But it's clearly there in the sense that the choices that the writers and director made are obvious. I mean, they wouldn't have called him Tyler Durden if, you know, they knew what they were doing. You know, there's no question about this being a conscious expression of Gnosticism.
Now, I agree.
Who were they? In other words, who did it? Who made this film this way?
Right. You're looking, you know, this is a multi-leveled effort. And it depends on the sophistication of the filmmakers. You are dealing with writers. You are dealing with production designers and prop decorators. That's probably not the right word I'm looking for, but, you know, the sort of the prop department, I guess, or the, you know, production design, I guess that's probably the better word, and certainly the director. You know, you get into films crafted by people like John Carpenter, people like Stanley Kubrick, my goodness gracious, people like Darren Aronofsky, who we just mentioned. I mean, these people are master craftsmen, and they know what they're going for, and they know how to do it, and they know how to manipulate, and they're very good at it. And it's interesting because you will find they leave their fingerprints behind a lot of times. There was a movie, one of Aronofsky's movies that's very esoteric, has a lot of esoteric symbolism in it, is really overloaded with it. It was a movie called Black Swan.
Sure does.
Yeah.
I was just going to bring it up, but go right ahead.
No, and well, what's really interesting with this is, and I did this, occurred to me when I was doing my research, this movie is very overloaded with esoteric symbolism. And a few years later, I think about three, four years later, a movie came out. It was sort of an indie house movie. It didn't go into a lot of, you know, it played to a lot of theaters. But it was a very interesting movie. I liked it. It's not for everybody, but the movie was called Stoker. And it starred Nicole Kidman and Mia Wasikowska. And if you watch this movie, you will see, you know, you will see things in this movie that you see in Black Swan. And I was researching it, and the production designer, the same woman, did both movies. And that, you know, that helped explain it, because she uses some of the exact same techniques in Black Swan that she brought to Stoker, or vice versa. So, you know, these filmmakers leave their fingerprints behind an awful lot of times, letting you know that they're doing this. The real master craftsmen, the people like Kubrick, and these are the guys who really know what they're doing, is that they'll take a movie, say like The Shining, and they'll incorporate repetition in it, but then they'll do another movie such as Eyes Wide Shut, and they'll leave the repetition aside and go for another aspect. The point I'm making is, they know the symbolism that plays out. They do it in the proper context. They know when to contextually use symbolism or esoteric undercurrents, and know when to pull back, and know when to put them in, and know when they should differentiate, and know when they should be similar. And that's really the hallmark of the master craftsman, the master director. And again, you look at movies like with Kubrick or Aronofsky or Carpenter, just naming a few. You know, a lot of their movies are very adroitly made. And it's a really fascinating study, and you know, it's fascinating. I really believe that.
Yeah, I could not agree with you more. This book is just, you know, for a writer, this book is gold, because it really, not only does it get me into a lot of things about movies that I didn't know, it also gives you insight into the thinking of directors you might want to work with. So, yeah, I'm working on right now on a new treatment of The Wolf, and so it was a good moment for this to come into my life. And Free Dreamlanders, it's a good moment for these announcements to come into your lives. And now for my new thing. This is Whitley Strieber, and Anne and I have got a new book out called The Afterlife Revolution. You can get it for your Kindle. It's soon going to be available as an audiobook and as a paperback on Amazon. You can find it all there. This is a book that happened because within hours of passing on, Anne came back, and she did it very cleverly, so that I couldn't say to myself, it's just my imagination. What she says is so illuminating and so surprising, like, I asked her, what are you now? And she said, we're light, alive. I asked her what enlightenment was, and she said, enlightenment is what happens when there is nothing left of us but love. The book's full of material like that and lots more. What a journey it's been for Anne and Whitley, from a deathbed to this beautiful new relationship The marriage goes right on down the road. We have not finished with each other yet. Join us in the afterlife revolution. We're talking to Robert Sullivan. He's back with Cinema Symbolism 2. You do not need to read the first book in order to get into the second. And it's very worth doing because being conscious of what you're doing in your life is so vitally important. And when we go to the movies, we go to be entertained, we become very passive. But that's not necessary. The movies are telling us something. They are moving us as well as moving the light across the screen. So his website, by the way, forgot to mention, is robertwsullivanthefourth.com. That's robertwsullivaniv.com. Now, Robert, you know, we can't go much farther, and we're going to talk later about some of the amazing science fiction movies in the second half of the show. That's what we're going to concentrate on. But right now, I want to go to Stanley Kubrick and The Shining, which I'm telling you, after I read the section of your book about The Shining, I went and put in a Blu-ray of it I have, because it's better than streaming. It's so much better on the screen. And I watched it again with new eyes. It was unbelievable. What an experience. Tell us, you know, I just want you to riff. I can't ask you specific questions about The Shining. There's too many. I don't know where to start. Just riff on this a little bit. Okay?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no problem. This is one of my all-time favorite subjects, is Stanley Kubrick's The Shining. Great movie anyway, but this is really overwrought with hidden symbolism. What Kubrick is obsessed with doing in that movie is bombarding your subconscious mind with repetition. And why does he do that? Why is he picking repetition? What he is symbolizing with this repetition is this symbolic Ouroboros that the Overlook Hotel is. It is an endless, vicious reincarnation cycle that is endlessly repeating through Delbert Grady, Charles Grady, and Jack Torrance. It's all repeating itself all over again.
Because you overlook. Tell us the meaning of the word overlook here.
The Overlook Hotel itself symbolizes the dark side of the United States of America.
And why is that? This is so lovely. Why is that?
Well, right. It has to do with this conflict that Kubrick puts in the film, where the Overlook is this dark alchemical side of the United States. It's this dark opulent side. It's built on the Indian burial ground, symbolizing the United States. Burying the Indian nations. Even he says it, all the best people stay here are the Hollywood movies people, you know, the Hollywood movie stars, the politicians. It's all the best people. So the Overlook itself is symbolically representing the United States of America. You have the two weapons of choice by the two characters representing Native Americans and, European Americans. You have Jack Torrance wielding the tomahawk axe of the Native Americans, and of course Wendy is wielding the baseball bat, the American pastime. If you pay attention to the movie, a lot of the characters are seen wearing red, white, and blue costumes, symbolizing the American flag. And in fact, at one point when Danny and Wendy are going into the hedge maze, you'll see American flags on the trash cans. And Wendy actually says, "We got to clean up trash. We got to keep America clean." And Danny actually repeats it back to her. He says, "Yeah, keep America clean." Symbolizing that the hotel is a representation of this dark side of America. But it's really the repetition in this movie that is the symbolic treasure trove in this film. And what Kubrick does is, I mean, you'd ask me at the beginning of the show about whether this stuff is intentional. Well, this is a no-brainer because this is intentional.
Oh, yeah, this one, no question, it's intentional.
Yeah, this is where he takes numbers and things and themes in this movie and just endlessly repeats them over and over and over again. And he does this through doubles and repetition and repeating numbers. For example, there are two sets of twins, the little girls, and then when Ullman is showing Jack and Wendy the apartment, two twin girls walk by her and he says, "Have a, you know, nice summer or nice winter, ladies." The number 12 repeats. This is a number that Kubrick really likes to use, the number 237, the hotel room.
Now, why do those numbers, why are they so important?
He seems to have picked these numbers, the number 21, the number 12, the number 42. why he likes these specific numbers. You could say the number 12, you're getting into astrological themes. This is an alchemical movie. This has to do with the transition of the self. So the number 12 is likely the 12 houses of the zodiac. You get the number 42, which is the number 21 doubled. The number 21 repeats itself all over the place.
The number 21 has enormous esoteric significance because it's three sevens. A seven is a complete octave. Three complete octaves are envisioned as a sort of super triad where three different levels of life are completed. So 21 and 42 are very, very powerful numbers.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. And you know, you have even at the beginning of the movie, you know, the road that he's traveling on is called the Going to the Sun Road. That was built in 1921. You have at the end of the movie, the photographs is in three rows of seven, 21 again. If you double the number 21, you get 42. Danny has the number 42 on his T-shirt at the beginning of the movie. Scatman Crothers has the number 42 on his license plate. The movie that Danny and Wendy are watching in the Overlook is the Summer of 42. So yeah, this repetition is all, and you even have at one point, I mean, if you pay attention to the movie, the characters a lot of times will repeat lines back to each other. The little twin girls say to Danny, stay with us here in the hotel forever and ever. And then about 10 minutes later, Jack Torrance is sitting on the bed with Danny and says, I want you to stay here with me forever and ever. So we have repetition there. We have doubles all over the place. I mean, Jack in his wallet has two tens and two twenties. There's two Portland mentioned, Portland, Oregon, and I think Portland, Maine. I mean, it's just this, and you know, the number 12. There's two times flashed on the screen, 8 and 4 at 8 plus 4 to get the number 12. Jack throws the ball against the wall 12 times. He hits the door with the axe 12 times. There's 12 pounds of sugar in the pantry. The name of the hotel, the code word for the hotel is KDK12. So yeah, this is all very intentional. Kubrick was a master at it. And what he's doing by doing all this repetition is he is supplanting, he's planting in your subconscious mind this violent, vicious reincarnation cycle that the Overlook Hotel is. It's this symbolic Ouroboros that is forever, endlessly biting its own tail. Which is also a very alchemical symbol.
Very alchemical symbol. Yeah. And as far as the number 42, 42 generations between Abraham and Christ in Matthew, 42 generations between David and Christ in Luke.
Absolutely.
The beast is in Revelations given 42 months in which to act and blaspheme. The famine of Elijah lasts 42 months. And we have also a limited amount of time here until finally it is already past time and the innocent must wield a bat in order to save freedom. Am I right?
Yeah. It's fascinating. And like I said, what's great with The Shining is this is a great example of this because you know this stuff is intentionally done. There is no way that this is not a coincidence. With this, I mean, you know, you go back to doubles. There are two boilers. There are two mazes: the hedge maze and the actual hotel. She serves him two eggs. This is all very intentional. And Kubrick is a real master at this. I mean, and this is just, to me, an example of master craftsmanship. But, yeah, absolutely, the number 21, we have a sacred number. The number 12, sacred number. 42, sacred number. And he just likes repeating this stuff over and over again. And it is an alchemical movie. Let me just point that out so as well. So what's an alchemical movie? These are not movies that have to do with transforming base metal into gold, unless it's the James Bond movie Goldfinger, which is pretty much exactly that. When I say an alchemical movie, we're talking about a transition of the self where the character starts as one thing and then by the end of the film has gone through an alchemical change and has become something else. And this is what you have in The Shining where the Jack Torrance character starts off as this kind of eccentric failed writer, and by the end of the movie he's gone through this alchemical transition where he is a raving homicidal maniac. Interesting also that Kubrick, another thing that he subliminally plants in the movie, this is very adroitly done, is, you know, you're mentioning Whitley about the biblical imagery in the movie. Jack Torrance, in the film, he basically begins his demonic downfall when he takes the drink from Lloyd, the ghostly bartender, who is, of course, an analog pretty much for the devil. But that's when Jack takes the drink of alcohol, that's when his ruination begins. Jack Torrance drinks the alcohol at 66 minutes, 6 seconds into the film, 666.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, Kubrick was an amazing man. I mean, you talk about a deep human being. Really, I mean, this isn't the only one of his movies that's this kind of textured like this, but it's got, this is his great tapestry in terms of esoteric thought and meaning.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, The Shining is definitely a home run. He plays with esoteric and occult symbolism in Eyes Wide Shut as well, although he does it differently. He does not use repetition in Eyes Wide Shut. He uses a lot of imagery relating to lights, namely Christmas lights, and he uses esoteric imagery. Eyes Wide Shut is one of those movies where if you just sit there and watch it, and you just watch it on its surface, you might get a little bored with it. But if you watch it symbolically, it has a lot of deeper meaning to it. It has a lot of deeper esoteric imagery in it. This was another movie I tackled in Cinema Symbolism too. This is what I call, this is the great example of the Illuminati in film is Eyes Wide Shut. You know, the secret, society pulling all the strings behind everything.
Right.
And it's an interesting movie. It's a good movie. It's probably not as good as The Shining. But if you watch the movie symbolically, you'll get a lot out of it.
Absolutely. You sure will. And folks, if you're a free Dreamlander, it's time to subscribe because we're going right on down the path to Blade Runner. And we have got so much more to talk about. There is so much more to learn. Dreamland is a learning experience. It's an entertainment. Of course, it's fun to listen to, I hope. But mainly, we're trying to get under your skin and deep into your mind to enable you to see the world in a new way. And one of the beautiful things about Robert's books is they enable you to do that. You read one of these books and you stream one of these movies and you have a whole new life experience, or read about one of these movies in his books, and you have a whole new life experience. I do it, and it's wonderful. Cinema Symbolism, Cinema Symbolism 2, RobertWSullivanIV.com. Subscribers, we're going to keep on keeping on. Free Dreamlanders, thank you for listening.
You've been listening to Dreamland. Be sure to tune in again next week. Dreamland is brought to you by UnknownCountry.com and its family of subscribers. Unknown Country was founded by Ann Streber. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our coordinator is Amy Safrankova. Whitley Streber is your Dreamland host, and I'm your announcer, Ted Alexander. Thank you for listening.